Okay, so I am here once again with Steve Erickson, who is most recently the author of These Dreams of You. Steve, how are you doing?
Good, Ed. How are you?
Pretty good. Like Zeroville, which we last talked about, These Dreams of You shows this interesting commitment to short narrative segments. You have only a few sections in this book that are more than a page. And to my mind, these bursts almost mimicked the creative burst of a frustrated writer trying to start his novel. It kind of reflects your protagonist, Zan, who's
right.
Doing that. There's also this postmodernist idea about Mr. X plagiarizing the future. So the question is, why this short, fragmented textual approach seems to be the one that's working for you? Is this just reflecting what your thoughts are in terms of the current trajectory of literature or the themes in this book? Just to start off here.
Well, I did something a little bit similar with a novel called The Sea Came In at Midnight, although it wasn't quite as fragmented as this. In the case of Zeroville, it made sense because it was a novel about the movies,
mm-hmm.
and I was trying to catch the sense of the way movies are cut up into short scenes that move quickly from one to the other. In the case of this novel, it was I don't think I had as conscious an idea as that one was with Zeroville until I was further into the novel and realized it. Is that the novel was becoming kind of kaleidoscopic or a bit of a mosaic, if you will. There's a lot of different things going on in this novel, and the idea was to get that kaleidoscopic quality and also hopefully carry the reader from one bit to the next and create some kind of momentum that way.
Yeah, but in terms of Zan, I mean, did the short burst spring from him, or did they perhaps spring from the necessity of, like, maybe perhaps writing like one burst at the end of the day or at the beginning of the morning or something like that?
No, it wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't that thought through. It was more intuitive at the outset, and then, like I say, the rationale for it sort of emerged as I was well into the novel. I don't think it was a case of replicating Zan's psyche I think in the case of this novel, maybe more than Zeroville, it was actually just the opposite. It was a sense that there was this bigger picture going on and that it was going to kind of fragment into all of these bits,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of the work in the novel was about choices being made as to what to include and what not to include. A lot of things got cut. This was when I finished it. It was closer to a 350-page novel, so 50 some pages got lost, and that was because it felt important to first of all achieve a balance among all of these things, and secondly, you know, there was a lot of thought went into how to orchestrate all of them.
Sure. Well, this leads me to ask, at what point does the rationale tend to kick in for a book with you? I mean, it might almost seem to be a blessing as well as a curse, especially if you're trying to go for this intuitive thing.
Yeah, I think this is actually more typical. The as opposed to a Zeroville, where I kind of had an idea about what I was doing from the beginning, maybe because Zeroville was in my head for a long time and I had more time to think about it. But generally speaking, you know, I start with a sense of the novel. I start with the beginning. I kind of know where it's going to end up. And a lot of things start to achieve clarity as I'm well into the novel. The material starts to kind of tell me what it is, and the characters start to kind of tell me who they are. And that's the more typical way that I write, which is why, for instance, you know, I don't make outlines. I don't write from an outline. I don't write from notes. I kind of I kind of want to be open to the, quote, mistakes, unquote, and to the novel telling me things about itself that I didn't know when I started.
The profane words that Zan hears in these telephone conversations, I'm wondering, were you hearing these along with your character?
Well, I think that anybody who's had this kind of conversation, with banks or lending institutions or just generally bureaucratic institutions, the tone of what's being said starts to manifest itself rhetorically, if you will.
Yeah.
And so it was I'm not sure when I got the idea for it, but when I did, I knew that it captured something about the experience.
Were you being dunned at any time during the course of this when you were contemplating people who were calling you up, calling other people up asking for cash and that kind of thing? And
It's a very for all of the politeness of that suggested in the conversation, there's this underlying tone of contempt.
Yeah,
and it starts expressing itself semantically even when it's not said out loud.
Is this why near the end of the book, where the balance actually shifts, where Zan is imagined as saying these things, that you wanted to empower him with the imagined profanity?
Right, exactly right. Yes. Yeah.
Obama is never named in this book, nor are the two Kennedys or the David Bowie-like figure who pops up near the end. Ulysses is referenced but never mentioned, even as you have the nanny who is named Molly, who connotes Molly Bloom. There's also the question of Zima's name, to which you write, only by putting all of a person's names together do you complete the meaning. So this leads me to ask, what degree does your commitment to the ineffable in fiction reflect any commitment to understanding this American predicament of never contemplating the meaning, completing the meaning?
Right. Some of it is about leaving the reader to find his or her own meaning. As soon as you call a character Bobby Kennedy, some preconceived notion of who that character is emerges in the minds of even people who weren't alive when Kennedy was. And I wanted to, it was similar to something I did in Zeroville, where only occasionally are the names of movies given. I wanted to define something before I named it. I wanted to define something in the reader's mind before I named it. And then let the name emerge later. At some point, the reader realizes who this is, or who this character is, or who that character is. But rather than have that picture or the definition of that person presented up front, if that makes any sense. That's why I do that. It's a way of defining the character in terms of the story I'm telling, rather than in historical terms, or rather than in public terms, if you will.
The more fixed the notion, the more fixed the figure, the more oppressive it is for the reader or for you, the author.
I think so. Yeah, for sure. In the case of somebody like Robert Kennedy, I sort of steeped myself in Robert Kennedy before I wrote this novel. I read a lot about him. I watched a lot of stuff. I thought a lot about him. I listened to a lot of speeches. And then, having done all that, I tried to forget all of it. And basically create my version of that character, who the reader may come to understand is somebody named Robert Kennedy, who may or may not bear some resemblance to the Robert Kennedy that people know about. Again, it was a matter of defining the character in terms of the novel.
Was it like that? Did you listen to Low, Heroes, and Lodger over and over again before considering
Bowie?
Yeah,
I had a CD where I kind of cherry-picked those three three CDs and assembled my own master CD. I resequenced things. And
what tracks made the cut? Out of curiosity.
Well, most of Low made the cut, and probably about half of Heroes made the cut, and only one or two cuts from Lodger made the cut.
Huh, interesting. Does this also explain this idea of not having a fixed notion why American and European is not capitalized in this book, especially near the end? The notion of what America is decidedly without the capital A.
Right.
Both in literally and figuratively.
And the word has never appeared in the book until then.
Yeah.
Until the very final word. That was true of that case. In cases like a European, when I use it as an adjective, I tended to lowercase. And that, again, is one of those things where, you know, it makes sense to me when I'm doing it. I don't know that I would, you know, that I can lay out for you a rhetorical rationale for it.
Sure. You use some autobiographical details as the basis for this fiction. My understanding is that you had a similar experience in London. You have an adopted Ethiopian daughter. And there's a phrase that comes to mind from Jeanette Winterson's new book, Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal? Part fact, part fiction is what life is. I'm wondering, in drawing upon your own autobiographical details for this novel, does this allow you to demolish the hard boundaries of fiction in life? And on a related note, I have to ask, did you ever date a Stalinist?
I did date a Stalinist.
You did?
That was many years ago. I think probably any novelist can tell you that that fact and fiction become very vague terms when you're writing a novel, which is to say the facts, quote unquote, are always more informed by imagination than is indicated. And the fiction, quote unquote, is always more informed by real life. And the two blend, and a novel's, you're constantly dealing with imagination and experience and trying to achieve the balance between those two and trying to find where those two naturally melt into each other. And you want a conspiracy of those between those two rather than a collision of them. And there are facts that are not entirely factual, and there's fiction that's not entirely fictional. And that is certainly the case in this particular book.
What invented details allow you to create this conspiracy we're talking about?
What invented?
What do you do to encourage the conspiracy?
I think it's more an overall strategy that you don't get the temptation, especially when you're a younger writer.
Yeah.
You feel honor bound to be true to the things that are true. And as you get older, you forget about that. You don't feel honor-bound to be true to the things that are true. You feel honor-bound to be true to the truth of the novel. And the truth of the novel isn't always corresponding to what was true in your life. And, I'll give you one interesting example of the potential minefield of this, which is the only reservation that my editor had when I turned in this novel, was he said, I don't believe that a four-year-old could say some of the things that this four-year-old says. Now, the last refuge of a bad writer is to answer, but in fact, that's what happened.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if that's what happened in real life. If it's not convincing on the page, then it doesn't work. And so I wound up taking out things that in fact, I know a 4-year-old can say. I know for a fact a 4-year-old can say.
Yeah.
Because, I was running the risk of taking the reader out of the novel. I was running the risk of straining the reader's credibility. So my daughter can be unbelievable, but my character can't.
Yeah. But are there certain things that say a four-year-old can say that you know they can say that are just going to be incompatible with a fictional terrain? And what do you do? Do you
That's
feel
what I'm talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly that. Yeah. There were and for that reason, there were things that I cut, and she still comes off as a very precocious four-year-old.
Sure.
But there were things that my editor just, you know, found unbelievable, even though, as I say, I know for a fact these things were said.
Yeah.
I think you put it well, that they were incompatible. They're incompatible with the fiction terrain, and they're incompatible with what a reader will accept.
Yeah.
And that's a small example of the larger point I'm trying to make about
sure.
not getting too locked into notions of what's true and what's not true, because there are times when you're going to have to bend even the you're going to have to bend the truth because it sounds too fictional. You know, that's the paradox.
I'm wondering, I mean, you've been around a while, and this leads me to ask if you've experienced more dialogues with your editors along these lines of, well, this couldn't happen. I mean, if we're talking about fiction in a post-James Frey world, we've had recent developments mm-hmm. with, of course, Coney and Mike Daisy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, is fiction under attack by this notion of believability, by this notion of adhering too much to the facts? And what do you do as a writer to combat that?
Well, I don't know, you know, without getting too much into, you know, the James Frey stuff,
yeah.
for instance, was that a flaw of the writing, or was that a flaw of the marketing?
Yeah.
You know, the book was marketed as a memoir.
Yeah.
When in fact it was really a novel. He just didn't call it a novel.
Sure.
And so the reader felt defrauded by the idea that it had been presented to him or her as a memoir, even though knowing it's a memoir or knowing it's a novel doesn't change one syllable in the book. It's
mm-hmm.
still the same exact book. It's just what we know about it, and how it's been presented to the reader. As a writer, there's part of me that thinks, who cares?
Yeah.
You know, it's the same book. Read it as a book. But the problem, of course, is that if they had marketed the book as a novel, it wouldn't have gotten the same attention. It got the attention it got because people thought it was true.
Yes.
And it's an interesting question whether it's really the truth that's under attack or the fiction that's under attack. But paradoxically, we live in a world where even as people, even as lines between fact and fiction blur, or maybe because lines between fact and fiction blur, people hold on more tightly to what they believe they know to be true and what they believe they know to be fiction.
But can you, as a reader, take away any sense of authenticity if it's being marketed or if it's being thrown into the media as a lie? I mean, maybe you as a novelist are on a better playing field because you can have conversations with your editor about
right.
what is believable and what is not.
Right.
And you can always get away with it because it's a pack of lies anyway. So the question is, you know, I mean, can we enjoy James Frey or Mike Daisy or anything else
right.
If we know that there is a fundamental lie attached to it? Can we enjoy fiction? I mean, we can enjoy fiction knowing it's a lie because we believe in it, but we can't do that for
yeah,
nonfiction.
I think that's a great observation.
Yeah.
And the immediate answer seems to be no, we can't. That people, you know, that again, people felt like they had been scammed
yeah.
when they were presented something they believed to be true, and it turned out to be fiction. Maybe because readers are not investing in something like that. They're not vesting themselves in something like that on in literary terms. They're vesting themselves in personal terms.
Yes.
They're not assessing the skill with which the thing is written. They're assessing how the thing was presented to them.
Yeah. To steer this conversation into dreams, possibly jumping off from this, I wanted to actually ask you about some of the fascinating disappearances in this. You know, kids disappear. You have this very strange photo that appears on a Facebook-like page, not even named Facebook. What's interesting is that the photo disappears at one point, but the comment that is left actually stays, mm-hmm. which is a very interesting comment upon the idea of the text as commentary. I'm wondering if you're concerned with believability in one sense as to what a four-year-old can say, and also the sort of crazed disappearance that becomes almost phantasmagorical, what is the balance you strike here?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure I've got an answer for it. As you may know, I've sort of been doing stuff like this in all of my fiction from the outset. And, it's something that sort of instinctively comes naturally to me. I'm not writing fantasies as such. I'm not writing surrealism as such. I'm not writing, I'm not writing magical realism as such. It's the things I write have a little bit of all of all of that. And they also have some traditional narrative. And at some point back, when I wrote my first book, that vision, if you will, took on a kind of sense that a sense of something that I hadn't been able to define for myself before. And I think it was at that point where I made the leap that I needed to make as a writer to become published, even though, to get back to the marketing question, my fiction is kind of has confounded publishing marketeers from the outset. The balance between those things and the choices I make in terms of a photo that vanishes I have to fall back on the same argument or answer that I've given probably for the better part of 30 years, which is that it makes sense to me when I do it.
Sure.
And it's not always something I can explain even to myself. And it's, how much of it is a reflection of something unconscious or semi-conscious, I don't know, but I suspect at least some of it is.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it says something about, the way I see, existence, for lack of a smaller term. It's difficult for me to, that's the kind of question that is difficult for me to answer.
Maybe another way to approach it, and this is one I didn't really pick your brain on last time, but I'm hoping I can do now, is that as we have seen postmodernism shift to something that is not cool, that is not something that we want to actually have in print, in any form, that is just something that people recoil from.
Right.
Has this caused you as an author or an editor to almost fence yourself in, or have these limitations allowed you to create new forms of literary possibilities?
Well, you see, the thing is, I never thought of myself as a postmodernist, and I've been called that.
Yeah.
I've never known completely what it meant. I get a sense that it refers at least a little bit to some consciousness of the artifice in fiction or in any kind of art, and that's an artifice that was never interesting to me. I've never written a novel where I wanted to be be continually broadcasting to the reader, this is a novel.
Yeah.
I have a very old-fashioned, you know, approach in the sense that I want to pull the reader into the reality of that novel. I want to do it on my terms. You know, but there is a certain remove, I think, in postmodernism that I always rejected in my work. Now, you know, the fads come and go, fashions come and go, and I'm not sure I've ever fit neatly into any of them, either coming or going, which, you know, in some ways has been problematic from the standpoint of a career as a novelist, because we do live in a culture, you know, that wants to pigeonhole things. I don't know whether, you know, that's a function of late 20th century, early 21st century culture, or is a function of American culture, or some combination of the two. In Japan, for instance, they don't seem to worry about that when it comes to my novels.
But with Zeroville and with Dreams, I mean, we have moved a little bit more towards traditional narrative. I mean, maybe the impulse was always there, but do you think this has just been symptomatic of what you've been more occupied with of late, sort of fusing that traditional narrative with some of these additional ideas of disappearance, of inserting words into sentences and so on?
Right. It's hard for me. It's hard for me to know. There are still a lot of people out there who would read this novel, These Dreams of You, and think it's a pretty damn unconventional novel.
Yeah.
Compared to, you know, they may not have read Our Ecstatic Days.
Yes.
And thereby see this novel as whatever you want to call it, more accessible, I can tell from the reviews I've gotten on this novel, which have largely been somewhere between good and better than good.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, there are reviewers out there who really don't quite know what to make of even this particular novel, which I think you've rightly said, steers a little bit more toward the conventional than earlier novels. And in the case of Zeroville, I had a strategy from the beginning, having thought about this novel for a while. I had started the novel at one point, and it I was writing it differently. And I was writing it, I don't mean differently in terms of my earlier books. It was written more like my earlier books. And I stopped, and I threw it out because I felt like this novel is about loving the movies, being obsessed with movies. It should have some of the energy of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
It should follow some of the narrative laws of a movie. So you had a lot of dialogue and a lot of the story being told in external terms, being told in dialogue, being told in action, not a lot of motivational stuff. The main character in that novel, we never quite know where he's coming from. We never know if he's some kind of savant or just socially and mentally challenged. We never know. In the case of this novel, you know, I was aware at some point that I was, first of all, I was writing a story about a family, which I had never done. And secondly, I was writing a story that it became clear to me really from the first scene that addressed the national moment and a moment that any reader could recognize.
Yes.
In a way that none of my other novels quite had.
Sure.
You know, there was not, you know, Los Angeles was not submerged in a lake or covered by a sandstorm. It was, you know, out of that opening scene of the novel, which was the real life scene that led to writing the novel. You know, I emerged a story that I thought would be recognizable to most readers, and I didn't want to completely lose that. There are a lot of times in the novel that I think that is challenged that recognizability, or that recognition rather, of the contemporary moment. You know, halfway through the book, the story suddenly changes track. But even as I was, you know, as I was taking the reader, even as 3/4 of the way through the book, I knew the reader was going to be saying, "Where is this thing going?"
Yeah,
I didn't want to lose that connection between the book and a national a moment of national history. Except it's a history that's still going on. It's not
sure.
A history of the past, but of the present. I didn't want to lose that connection.
But why did you feel at this point with this novel that you needed to respond to the national moment? I mean, history is something, especially as it is unfolding, that one doesn't necessarily feel obliged to respond to. You know, so now you're getting into questions of, well, is it possible that you are, you know, kind of giving into the reader somewhat in light of the conditions that we were describing earlier? I mean, you know, where did this need to respond to the 2008 climate come from?
Really? I think it was completely personal.
Yeah,
I was sitting on the sofa watching, you know, the election in November 2008 election night with my black daughter.
Yes,
and I knew this was a singular moment for me, and I knew it was a singular moment for her. And it was a singular moment for the country.
Yeah.
And it was one of those cases where the story sort of made itself manifest to the point of screaming at me. You know, here's a story that that not many other people are in a position to tell, given
yes.
given the circumstances of their lives, as those circumstances were coinciding with the circumstances of the country.
Sure. I want to actually go back into the intertextuality within the novel. You have this character, J. Wilkie Brown, the Brit who invites Zan over to give the lecture on the novel as a literary form facing obsolescence in the 21st century, or the evolution of history to pure fiction. Now, if we call journalism the first draft of history, it's interesting that you also describe that Zan's single triumph over Brown is that in time-honored journalistic tradition, the world-famous journalist always longed to write a novel.
Mm-hmm.
It's also interesting that Zan must return to his American roots, the original British origin point, right? It's to collect his thoughts on how he has dealt with words. And I'm wondering how much this relationship between history and pure fiction is predicated on Anglo-American relations, and can any novel or any life entirely deflect the crusade against gray that you mentioned?
The crusade against what?
The crusade against gray. It's when you're describing Ronny Jack Flowers
uh-huh.
And his, the specific content of his views, which I want to talk about him a little bit too, if it's possible too.
Yeah, that's a big question. You know, early on, Zan wonders. Or actually, an omniscient narrator wonders, by way of Zan, if you know, if this is the sort of history that puts novelists out of business.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure I've got a sweeping cultural answer for all of this. I at some point early on in my life, well before the 21st century, you know, I knew I was a man out of time. I knew that, you know, the great art form of the 20th century was film, and I still believe that. And at the same time, popular music was rendering other media kind of obsolete, or in terms of relevance, was usurping all of these other forms. But I'm a guy, you know, my talent and my temperament is to write novels, you know, and I should have probably been born 50 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And so I you know, I as much as I would love to convince myself that you know, that I am operating in the central cultural arena of the time. I know I'm not. You know, I know that this that more and more that fiction becomes not a fringe form because too many people still read, but a and not even a secondary form, but a form that becomes more private, that is not shared with the culture at large. You know, I mean, people read novels in private. Whereas they still tend to watch movies in public, even as we watch more and more movies by ourselves at home, even as they tend to still respond to music in public, whether they're in the car listening to their sound system, or so it's what I do, and it's what I'm stuck doing, and the relevance or significance of fiction in relationship to history or journalism is almost beside the point for someone like me.
Yeah. So working in a cultural medium that is below the mass culture omnipresence is the best way for you to negotiate these issues of history and
I think
more dignified way.
The answer is it's the only way I know. That's all. I mean, I don't know that it's the best way or the more dignified way. Or I mean, I can't rationalize it in those terms. I mean, in a way, I would like to be able to.
Yeah.
But this is what you know. This is what I, you know, at some point early on, I thought about filmmaking. You know, when I was in college, I was actually a film student.
Yes.
But I recognized at some point that, for better or worse, whatever talent I had, I felt I had some talent writing fiction. I had no idea whether I'd have any talent writing, making movies. But perhaps even more importantly, temperamentally, you know, fiction is the province of a loner. You know, fiction is about locking yourself up in a room and having as little social interaction with other people as possible.
Yeah.
And living in this world that you've created. There is nothing collaborative about it in the way that film is, or even making music is. So it's the answer to your question is entirely personal.
Yeah.
It's entirely personal. It's what I was just meant to do.
You just have an anti-collaborative temperament?
Absolutely, I do. It's more than that. I've got an anti-social temperament. I mean, I really, and one of the, as I teach in a writing program back in California, and one of the things I have a lot of problems actually with writing programs and writing workshops, and I tell my students this. I said, you know, the thing is, the paradox is that a writing program, you know, socializes what is really an antisocial endeavor. There's something very strange about shutting yourself off from the rest of society to create this world or reality that's completely yours, and that you don't share with anybody until it's done. And even then, you share it on a very private basis. If somebody's sitting across the room there and they're reading one of my novels,
yeah,
I'm going to leave. You know, I don't want to be there. You know, because even though I know that it's now that the public has complete access to it, what I did still remains so private to me. I don't want to be around when somebody's reading my work. Except for cases like this, I don't especially want to have casual conversations about it.
Yeah.
Perhaps strangest of all, and I've heard a number of other writers say this. I heard Jonathan Lethem say it a few weeks ago. People will come up to me, for instance, and ask me about a section in a book, and I have no recollection of what they're talking about.
Yeah.
I have no recollection of writing it. I have no recollection of what I was thinking when I wrote it. I often have to ask them to show me what it is, because I was utterly immersed in that, and then it's done, and I need to leave it behind.
Running away from people who are reading your books, I mean, does this create any problems for you to go about your life? I mean, you know, if you're interested in the types of things that Steve Erickson readers are likely to be interested in, this could create some intriguing social problems.
Well, I, you know, as uncomfortable as it may make me to be in the same room, I would love to tell you that my life is littered with scenes of people reading my books everywhere I go. But that's not the case. So it doesn't happen that it doesn't happen that often. But I don't, you know, I don't have a lot of conversations with people about with people who are casual friends about my work.
Yeah.
And I don't want to. So in that sense, it makes the anti-sociability, is that the right word for it? The anti-sociability of the writing and the work, it does go on it bleeds in outside the lines of the life of that work, and it bleeds into areas of my other life where even though I'm always a writer, I don't want to be interacting with people as a writer.
Yeah. So is there any place for community, an increasing term used, I find, in writing, you know, like we have a literary community and so forth.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, is this kind of a logical extension of what some people find at, say, you know, AWP or MFA workshops? I mean, you know, is there any possible place for community for you,
well,
or that you would find valuable?
For me, not especially.
Yeah.
I mean, for other writers, perhaps. But I've said it before, and I've been to AWP, and I've been to, you know, book conventions and the LA Times Festival of Books, and I can even derive a certain amount of pleasure out of it for 24 hours, but to meet other writers but the only literary community that gets any writing done is a community of one.
Yeah.
And at the point that it becomes too much a salon, then I check out of it.
Yeah. So for you, being antisocial is the truest temperament for an artistic writer.
Well, I don't know how you can be anything else. I mean, certainly at the moment that you're doing the work. For me, that's true, yes. I can't speak for other writers.
Well, Steve Erickson, Community of One, thanks so much. I'm glad I could at least be a second.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to chat.
It was a great pleasure.
Thanks. Okay, cool.